From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Used to be if you wanted to do something about the environment, you sent a check to Greenpeace or the Sierra Club. Today, writing a check isn't enough because across the country, across the planet, people are fed up with a gas-guzzling American spend-and-waste way of life.
People are doing jobs that they may not enjoy as much as they'd like to, using skills that they don't consider their top skills, not living according to what they consider to be their values. And then on top of all that, they're finding out that the way that we're living is harming the planet.
The number of Americans who feel that they're living very happy lives peaks in about 1956 and goes slowly but fairly steadily downhill since. In that same 50 years, our material prosperity is about trebled. It's clear that more isn't producing satisfaction.
In this hour, why people around the world are taking the future of the planet into their own hands by unplugging, downsizing, scaling back on fossil fuels. A spontaneously emerging grassroots ecological movement is changing the way we live, the way we work, and the future we imagine.
There is a chance, I think, that they'll look back and at this time and say it was the darkest of ages, or they will look back at it and say this was another age of a great transformation.
Every now and then a story hits a nerve in our collective consciousness. That was the case recently when a mild-mannered writer named Colin Bevan began blogging about his and his wife's experiment in what they call no-impact living. Talk show hosts from Diane Sawyer to Scott Simon to Stephen Colbert all wanted to talk to him.
People are intent on replacing the American way with wind power and tree bark burgers.
Could you live with worms in your kitchen or without taking a bus or a subway, using cleaning liquids or toilet tissue?
Like this one New York family, the Bevans, who are 5 months into a year-long quest to live without impacting the environment. The rules? No toilet paper, no incandescent bulbs, or disposable razors, or magazines, or newspapers.
They eat only food grown within a 250-mile radius of their apartment.
Television, planes, trains, automobiles, elevators, plastic bags, or shopping for anything new.
They refuse to fly. They refuse to ride the subway or take an elevator. All of this in the middle of vertical downtown Manhattan.
It's like Gilligan's Island, only completely implausible.
After defending himself on the Colbert Report and Talk of the Nation, Colin Bevan may be happy to get back to composting worms by candlelight. In the meantime, he stopped by our New York studio to tell Ann Strainchamps how his life has changed in the past year.
I mean, I often say I'm just your typical Manhattan schlub trying to figure out how to live a life that doesn't make me feel as though I'm killing the planet. And in fact, although I believed in all the environmental conservation stuff, all I did was vote in a way that would help before. So both my wife Michelle and I, we work full time. I'm a writer. She's a writer. So, you know, at the end of the day, we'd be ordering takeout, lots of plastic tubs coming our way. At the weekend, in the summer, if we wanted to go to the beach, we'd be like, well, we could take the train, but no, on the other hand, we could rent an SUV. So my life was, I think this caused a mild depression in me because my life wasn't in line with my values. And so the idea of this project is to see, well, what happens if we just stop? What happens if we let go of all these conveniences and the consumption and see whether we really need that stuff and also whether our lives might turn out to be happier?
So paint us a picture of what your life is like now compared to what it was, say, a year ago. You went cold turkey on a lot of things. Like what?
So daily life now, you know, it used to be that breakfast would come. We'd get, even at breakfast, we'd often get the bagel man to come. Isabella, my little girl, would say, the man, call the man. But now we get up and we have breakfast, which is usually just toast. Which is made from my own bread that I make myself, because we have this local eating element. Then we kind of each go our separate ways. Isabella goes to the babysitter, which means carrying her down 9 flights of stairs because we don't use the elevators. And then
you
back
won't even
up 6
use the elevator?
We try not to. I mean, and, you know, again, at the beginning, we were like, even ourselves, we thought, this is crazy. But the fact of the matter is that we live on the 9th floor. By walking up and down the stairs all the time, I've lost the spare tire around my gut, and we're fit and healthy again. So it's funny because we also, for example, we don't use any carbon-emitting transportation at all. So I bicycle, and my wife, Michelle, uses a push scooter. We shop only at the farmer's market now because of the local food element. We can't buy anything in packaging. So
and you said no electric lights?
Yeah, and well, the electric lights went out on Saturday night.
So that means just getting used absolutely to that. No appliances. Do you have a refrigerator?
Right. Yeah, we're trying this technology called the pot in the pot, which is a Nigerian invention where there's one pot inside a larger pot with a layer of wet sand in between, and then water evaporates from the sand and it cools the inner pot.
You're using a little pot to
it's
replace your entire refrigerator?
No, no, it's a big pot. These are
but
big pots.
How many cartons of milk can you fit in it?
Well, I could fit a bunch of cartons of milk, but it doesn't keep the milk as cold as the refrigerator does. So what it means is that I just have to do the shopping more often. Instead of doing like shopping once a week, I do the shopping every other day.
You know, it's funny listening to a lot of the interviews you've done. Every interviewer seems to have a different thing they can't imagine doing without. So for the Times reporter, it was toilet paper. Scott Simon seemed to get kind of hung up on disposable diapers and olive oil. What else have you found stops people in their tracks?
Oh, the elevators. Well, the electricity. Honestly, the electricity is stopping me in my tracks a little bit. Our bedroom and our bathroom faces the ventilation shaft in our building, so there's not a lot of natural light, and that's bugging me a little bit.
Do you think this kind of thing can make much of a difference, or is it more sort of a sop to the conscience, kind of like a personal greenwashing?
I think it's there's three things. One, it can make a difference. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that just came out specifically said that changes in lifestyle can help. The second thing is that there's lots of people out there that feel bad, like I did, about the planet. I felt bad about the planet. And the fact of the matter is I just feel better and happier feeling as though I'm trying to do something. And last of all, I can't tell you how many people either write to me or come up to me, friends, strangers who go to my blog, all sorts of people. They say, you know, I can't do what you're doing, but I just read your blog and it made me think I should change the light bulbs, or I'm really thinking about what I can do differently in my life. And each of us can, it's a ripple effect. When each of us lives according to our conscience, it has an incredible power and it spreads outwards and other people pay attention too. So, you know, it has value for all sorts of reasons.
I know one of the things you wanted to do over the course of this year was document what you did, but also how you reacted. What do you think has been sort of the emotional trajectory of the experiment for you and for your wife and daughter?
The first day that we started this experiment, I was walking down the street, and, the experiment works in stages. So because just to do the whole thing at once was to bite off more than we could chew. So there was first no trash and then local eating and no carbon-producing transportation. And then we, keep all the things as we move along. So the very first day of the experiment was no trash. And I was walking down the street and I was hungry. And I was walking past bagel places and pizza places. And that stage, local eating wasn't part, but making no trash was. So I couldn't go into any of these places because it was all paper plates and paper napkins. And I started to, I was like, why am I doing this dumb experiment? What have I got myself into now? And everybody's, I walked past a BMW SUV and everybody else gets to do that and not care and have fun. It's not fair. Why do I have to? And then slowly but surely, I actually, started to see the value in what I was doing and also to feel better. And also my wife, my wife's a big shopper. She's happier because she doesn't feel all the time like she has to catch up with the Joneses sort of thing. We're less attached to stuff, I would say, is one of the things that's changed. Because we have no TV, we have our friends over a lot to play charades. Charades has become a big thing in our life. And we're finding this kind of relating with people more than just hiding out with our television is a lot more fulfilling. I would say our lives actually feel fuller.
Colin Bevan talking with Anne Strangechamps. You can keep up with his adventures in green living on his blog. Just come to our website, ttbook.org, and we'll link you there. This idea that an eco-friendly lifestyle isn't just good for the planet, but actually leads to more personal happiness, may sound awfully goody-goody. But it's borne out by some interesting new research. In fact, one of the most intriguing new directions in environmental thinking is exactly this, the connection between life satisfaction and planetary health. Writer Bill McKibben has been one of the leading voices on the environment for more than a decade. His 1989 book, The End of Nature, was one of the first to take the consequences of global warming seriously. Now, in a book called Deep Economy, he makes the case for an even more profound philosophical shift. The future of the environment, McKibben believes, depends on our ability to stop measuring economic success in terms of GNP and start thinking in terms of GNH, gross national happiness. In other words, McKibben told Steve Paulson, it's time to start questioning America's underlying assumption that bigger is better.
For a very long time, the only question we've asked is, can we make it bigger? And this is the sort of default assumption of our society. We've focused on this idea that more is better so relentlessly that we've failed to notice a couple of things. One, the kind of obvious one, is that more is wrecking the environment at a pretty fast pace. The less obvious, but in some ways more interesting, and more even more sort of subversive question that economists and sociologists really have only begun to pose in the last few years is economic growth actually any longer producing any gain in human happiness or satisfaction? The answer appears to be no. The data on American happiness and satisfaction indicates that the number of Americans who feel that they are living very happy lives peaks in about 1956 and goes slowly but fairly steadily downhill since, which is weird because in that same 50 years, our material prosperity is about trebled. Now, if the economy worked in the way that we intuitively think it does, those two curves should move more or less in tandem.
But there could be other reasons why people might be less happy. Maybe they don't like the material, the media culture that we're saturated with. That we could list all kinds of.
But it's clear that more isn't producing satisfaction. And the more we look at the data, it appears that the cause, more than anything else, is that the very act of gaining that affluence has weakened social connection and community enormously. And that's what people feel a strong lack of. I mean, think what we started to do in the 50s. We took that money and we began moving further out into the suburbs and building bigger houses. And we got the kind of first of the set of screens that we've been looking into ever since. And those things changed our lives in profound ways. They made them just sort of mathematically less likely that we were going to be in contact with other human beings. The number of close friends that an American has fallen dramatically in those 50 years. The amount of time that we spend eating with friends and family and things has fallen because, you know, we're taking all this time to make this money. We're living farther apart. We have more sort of toys to maintenance and things takes up our time. Without realizing what we were doing, we've traded off an awful lot of our kind of relational life for a very hyper-individualistic, accumulative life, and the trade-off doesn't seem to be working that well, never mind that it's also wrecking the planet.
So you're calling for a smaller scale of living. I mean, everything from the way we think about the economy to the communities that we live in.
I think that happily, the answer to both these dilemmas lies in somewhat the same direction, which is the creation of stronger local economies. And what's important about them may be less their scale than their localness. If, for instance, let's take food because it's the most obvious commodity. You use a lot less energy when you eat locally. One of the experiments I describe in this book is
spending a winter with my family, eating nothing that didn't come out of our small valley in Vermont where I live.
And it's worth pointing out that Vermont is a very cold, snowy place.
Cold place. If we can do it there, most of the country. And in fact, we ate really well. And, you know, we weren't ordering takeout from 2,000 miles away, which is essentially what the American food system consists of. So we were saving a lot of energy. But we were also making a lot of friends, the farmers and others that we were sort of beginning to rely on in a new way. And this turns out not to be the exception but the rule. A pair of sociologists followed shoppers first around the supermarket, then around the farmer's market. When they went to the farmer's market, these academics found that shoppers were having 10 times more conversations in the course of a visit. So, you know, an order of magnitude less energy being used and an order of magnitude more community being created, we're at least partway towards answering some of the real dilemmas that we find ourselves in.
Let me step back for a moment and talk about how you see the environmental movement in a bigger picture, because you've been writing about these things for a long time, for 20 years or so, going back to The End of Nature, which came out in, 1989, when you first issued the warning about global warming. My sense is that back then there was this perception of you as this young guy kind of hectoring us, sort of saying, you know, better do something if we're going to save the world. The global warming story has certainly turned out right, I mean, from your perspective, I mean, or wrong, I should say.
I would have been quite happy to have been proved wrong on this one, Steve.
But as you look back, I mean, I guess I'm sort of wondering whether the way you think about environmental issues is pretty much the way it was back then, or has your style of talking about these things, has it changed over the years?
I think the things that I've gotten interested in have, in a sense, been broader. The second book I wrote was a book called The Age of Missing Information, which was an attempt to understand why we were doing nothing about climate change. I went and found the largest cable TV system in the world, which was in Fairfax, Virginia. It had 100 channels. I got people to tape for me everything that came across them for 24 hours. So I had 2,400 hours of videotape. Took it home, went to Sears and got a recliner, spent a year watching. You know, that was my life for a year. And there were a lot of ideas that came across the cable, but the central one was, and it really hit me like a ton of bricks to kind of figure this out, which I should have figured out long ago, but that the central message of the consumer culture in which we live is, you're the most important thing on Earth. You're the heaviest object in the universe, and everything orbits around you. And we've enshrined this idea as human nature, not kind of remembering that most people in most places have had other things very near the center of their identity, the tribe, the community, their relationship with the natural world or with the divine or something that gave them more of a sense of identity, not obsessively rooted in themselves. That idea now seems to me so deeply linked to the environmental crisis that we find ourselves in that I keep returning to it over and over and over again. Our sort of solipsism is the source of so much of this incredibly wasteful consumption. But it's also, it turns out, at least this is the thesis of this book, Deep Economy, is the source of a great deal of our unhappiness as well.
Because we're cut off from other people, from the rest of the world?
From all those things. You would think it would make us incredibly happy to live a life focused exclusively on our own, you know, stuff, but it doesn't. It's gotten very deep into our culture. You know, I did a piece a little while ago for Harper's about an evangelical pollster, a guy named George Barna, who did a poll a few years ago, and his poll was designed to tease out how biblically literate the 85% of Americans who call themselves Christians are. 75% of American Christians thought the phrase, God helps those who help themselves, could be found in the Bible, instead of coming straight from sort of Ben Franklin channeling Aesop. And in fact, of course, the gospel message is entirely the opposite. Love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, you couldn't be more opposite. But the degree to which,
you know, all the parts of our lives have been sort of taken over by this obsessive focus on ourselves, I think is the dominant fact about the United States today. And it's reflected in so many things, including quite directly in the atmospheric composition, you know, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Bill McKibben's most recent book is called Deep Economy. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, how to live for a year on other people's trash, and a portrait of one of the last century's great conservationists, Beatrix Potter, the creator of Peter Rabbit. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.